You're where it's at, folks, here at allthingstrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Orit. And I'm still getting over how awesome that new intro is.
It is very awesome.
Way more natural. And so we discovered some hilarious things over the last week or so. I found out we had some serious sound balance issues working on fixing some of those. The worst one is episode 8, which is all on me. That was the one I had to record without Bob, so the sound is all out of
whack. Seriously enough, the last episode we did with Riser Radio.
Yeah, also.
Or, well, you did.
Yeah,
I mean, I wasn't here.
So, you know, that might have been our undoing. But we also discovered that episode 13 is missing.
Well, it's not on my machine at home, and it's not on the FTP anywhere.
So we're going to see if we can find it.
What I think probably happened is it got encoded on our recording machine, and I just forgot to upload it. It's probably what happened with it.
That's what I'm hoping.
Then I just didn't have the time to get to it.
But it'd be kind of fitting if it was episode 13, the lost episode.
I'll put it up as that.
Episode 3 was technically lost, but we just got rid of that one because it was so bad.
Well, we had a bunch of technical problems with that one is what it was. It was full of holes and audio gaps.
Episode 13, no one just knows what happens to it.
Yeah.
All right.
So, my name is now forever immortalized in Privateer Press.
Oh, really?
Yes.
As Production Warrior?
Not as Production Warrior. It is that amongst, you know, only spoken in, you know,
in hush whispers
in dark corners of the warehouse. And this is actually cool. We can actually talk about this because I cleared it with Simon earlier today.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it's a collector's edition or what it is, but there was several people in the office, and I don't know how many people in the warehouse were signing posters and rule books for both War Machine Hordes.
Yeah, I saw you doing that.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. I asked Jen, and she doesn't even know what it is. She just was told to get signatures for this thing. So mine, along with a bunch of other people's signatures, are on these. Like, I think they're going to be collector's editions is what I think they're going to be for War Machine and Hordes. So it's really cool. My name is now forever immortalized on this thing.
Okay, well, in my driving desire to be better than you in all things, I'm going to have to make sure that I get to sign something. I got signed on.
You could ask Jen if they're still hanging around. No, they're not, because they're getting shipped out now, actually. Yeah. They're already
Next round, it'll be my turn. But I want to give an update on the Star Trek RPG.
Oh, man.
Still really rad. We made our second round of characters, even more copying. Bob's been thrilled about that. They successfully rescued the Tholian freighter before the Klingons could in a little competitive rescuing game.
Yep.
And then they successfully made contact with an alien race who were all squid people, and they discovered some ancient ruins and got shot at by some Gorn.
We call them the Tridenians, is that right?
Yeah, well, because the system you guys had qualified, the system that they're from was labeled on Federation Star Charts as Omega Tritus.
Right.
And they don't have a spoken language, so their name for themselves doesn't really translate, because they communicate by, like, flashing light patterns on their bodies.
Yep.
So, like, their names don't translate as anything. They just refer to each... They, like, when they were in the negotiations, they had to keep calling the guys by their titles.
I gotta say, probably one of the favorite bits I had in that last session was where Graham's character was using his, mind meld on... Uh-huh. Was the general, right?
Yeah, the evil general.
Yes, where it was, United Federation of Planets were good people, and then Ari's character was doing the opposite with his telepathy to the prince.
Yep, the evil prince.
Which was, the Federation will come and burn the oceans off of your world. It's just like, ooh, my goodness, this is a terrible telepathy dynamic developing here. Because I shouldn't be too surprised, because Ari's character also wields a knife.
Comm officer with three ranks of knife. Man, I'm excited because there's going to be some complications between the first officer, who was an NPC, and Graham's secondary character. Because the first officer was like, no, you have to withdraw your shuttle to a safe distance, because we're in the middle of a fight.
And then Graham's
character was like, no, the ship's in danger, I have to help. And so he flew the character in, flew the shuttle in to get in the way, and, like, you know, did distract the Gorn ship, and maybe... saved the compass from taking a lot of damage, but the shuttle was destroyed in the process, and they lost a crewman. The first officer's going to be really mad.
Now, in two sessions, we've lost a shuttlecraft in each session, back to back.
And this was this was actually the first fatality on the crew. Not a player character by any means, but, you know, still a notable
hapless
event.
NPC.
Yeah, crewman Gates.
Oh,
I decided was
crewman Gates
was his name. And there will be a memorial to him next session. All right. And so today we are talking about the malleability of the space-time continuum in Star Trek, and how easy it is to bend and rupture and crack. And we've got a couple of specific anomalies, and then we have just some species that can apparently just do it whenever they feel like.
Well, what prompted me to want to talk about this mostly was I keep thinking and going back to The Traveler.
Yeah.
Is what it was. And how much that... kind of translates into, like, the Ubermensch.
The Traveler is powered by pedophilia.
That, I don't think that's wrong or anything like that. But, well, the part about him being pedophilia, not that pedophilia is right or anything like that. I'm not advocating that we should rape kids or anything like that at all.
Oh, my.
I hope I wouldn't have to clarify that in this day and age, but, you know.
It's the internet. You have to clarify everything on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the kind of train of thought I wanted to go on about the malleability of the Trek universe and how, like, all these races are ascending into this pure energy form and they can just manipulate space and time and all this stuff. How space, time, and thought are not so different from each other and all this craziness. But we can go on about anomalies and such, too.
Well, this is, I mean, like, I think there's time for both. I mean, what species do we have that are just moving towards being able to manipulate space, time?
Well, according to the Q and the Organians, humans are one of them.
Yeah, and that actually kind of, I mean, they kind of indicated that in All Good Things. That was, like, Q's big thing with that whole test was that he was like, hey, Picard, can your brain evolve for just a minute and figure this stuff out?
Yep.
And then they had that whole thing with the Traveler when they got taken to the edge of the universe and they had to think happy thoughts to get back.
Yep. Focus all your thoughts on the Traveler and his well-being.
Think about the Traveler being, I don't know, that, okay, so yeah, they did that.
Yeah, there was also the Organians fiddling around with the Enterprise crew, the Enterprise, where they went to that silicon-based virus planet, right, and they had to be quarantined. They had Trip and Hoshi, where Mayweather and
Reed were both. The Organians in Enterprise?
Yes.
Okay, I completely missed that part. When you said the Organians, I thought we were talking about the first time they showed up in TOS.
In TOS. Well, we'll get more to the Organians, specifically about that later, and how schizophrenic I think they are in their representation in TOS and Enterprise. But humans are very much on their way, according to what we've been exposed to in Trek lore, to this, you know, ascended, you know, state of being, which is, you know, you are pure energy now, and you can just go ahead and mess about with space and time however you feel like.
And that might explain a little bit about why the genetically engineered supermen in DS9 were so good at math that they could predict the future. I don't know if those two things are supposed to be related at all, but that always kind of bothered me, is that they were so smart they were basically prophets. And maybe if humanity is supposed to be evolving towards this ascension where space-time becomes putty in their hands.
Well, I mean, statistical probabilities, which is, I think, the episode you're talking about, right? Yeah. Where they're saying, oh my gosh, we can't win the war and whatnot, right?
Yeah, it's before that even. They predict a whole bunch of stuff. Like, they're like, you know, okay, so the Dominion is going to do this thing 2 years from now, and we know that because of these seemingly unrelated factors. And, like, all these other things that they were doing.
Right, but they got tripped up by really simple stuff, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they were,
like,
they
the,
were
the
clearly...
girl freed Bashir, for instance.
Right, they were not infallible.
You can't plan for that.
They were not infallible, but they were able to predict... They were able to make some, you know, surprisingly accurate predictions based on a very small amount of data.
Did any of them actually come to fruition?
Yeah, a number of them did.
Really?
Yeah, like they were able to figure out just, like, by a couple of like stray sentences that the what planet the Dominion wanted in their, you know, in
oh
their...
that stuff. I was actually more asking, like, anything in that episode that later came true in later on in the series.
Yeah, they some of their more far reaching stuff we weren't able they didn't ever come to fruition. Like, they predicted the Romulans would abandon their peace treaty with the Dominion. Well, In the Pale Moonlight happened before that could actually roll around, so we'll never know if the Romulans would have abandoned their peace treaty or not. I'd like to think they would have, because I think the Romulans aren't stupid. I don't think the Romulans were ever planning to wait the war out. I think they were just waiting for the Federation to get its ass suitably kicked so that they could come in and be the saviors of everybody.
Right.
But then Sisko and Garrick forced their hands. But anyway, back to, I think next on our list is the Ocampa.
Yes, the Ocampa. Now, the Ocampa are, I think, they were supposedly, at least, I don't know if Voyager writers actually planned this stuff out. Now, I've actually been watching through Voyager now recently on Netflix.
You poor man.
I know. Well, I've only seen, you know, like a handful of episodes of Voyager and not in, like, sequence. So this is actually, since it's on Netflix, my chance to march through it. I'm up to about halfway through season 4.
Yeah.
I just saw the episode where there's that gal who secretes pheromones that, like, makes you forget about her after, like, a couple of hours
right.
or so.
Like,
and
Chakotay's...
apparently, like, her and Chakotay were in love at some point.
Yeah, they were.
I was, like, just finishing that episode this morning before I left for work. So I'm about that far in the series right now. And the sense I get from the Ocampa is that they are very much an analogy for evolution at its finest.
Which is funny because they've evolved themselves into an extinction path with their whole, they can only have one child once, which means every reproductive cycle, their species will reduce by half.
Right. So you have to remind me a little bit about the Ocampa initially when we were introduced to them. We were introduced to them in the very first episode, Caretaker Parts 1 and 2.
Yes, yes.
They were, the race that we saw anyway, were being taken care of by the Caretaker, one of the Nacine, as they're called.
Do they actually have a name for their species now?
Nacine, N-A-C-E-N-E, and that was introduced in the second time we see a Caretaker, which is when they meet Ocampans again.
Right.
With the other Caretaker, the female Caretaker, on a much smaller array.
Evil little girl.
Yes, evil little girl. So we have these Ocampans being taken care of by this Caretaker, and I think it's effectively stunted their development as a society, or as a culture, as a race.
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think they weren't always that pathetic.
I mean, because we literally see Kes make this transformation from the very first episode all the way to season 4, to where she's getting her abilities developed by Tuvok, and then later the Ocampans they meet, even though they only meet them for, like, that episode, and they're evil, bad people.
I mean, I'll say, she eventually evolved out of being a main cast member.
Low blow.
Hey, let's blow get, the belt we hard. Need to get rid of somebody. All right, we can't get rid of Kim. Who should we get rid of? Kes. You sure you don't want it to be Neelix? Yeah, I'm sure. It's gonna be Kes.
Ethan Phillips must hang around. And she just evolves into this, you know, pretty much a state of energy where she's able to manipulate subatomic matter. And before that, she had like precognition abilities, telekinesis that was developing, and all this little stuff that she didn't have at all when she was living back on the Ocampa homeworld.
Yeah, you know, and I think they mentioned that there were like legends of Ocampa who had like psychic powers from way back in the day. So yeah. I could actually see, if you were trying to make sense of the Ocampa and their bizarre breeding habits, I could see that the Ocampa were this race that was, like, you know, rapidly gaining, you know, universe-manipulating thought powers, and the Caretakers came along and were like, ooh, we gotta contain this right quick, because these guys are gonna, like, wreck up the universe, something awful, and so the Caretakers, did something to him and messed him up real good.
Well, it was an accident first as well.
The Caretakers claimed it was an accident. I think it's more likely that...
That's true, the one that we saw did claim it was an accident.
And it was a really silly explanation, too. It was like, we had no idea that our scanners would be so destructive to their atmosphere. It's like, what, have you never scanned a planet before? How did you not know that?
How new to this exploration thing are you guys?
was this your first scanning of a planet?
Well, these guys are from a different galaxy. Right?
Are they?
Yeah, the Nacine are just from somewhere else entirely. That's not the Milky Way.
Heck if I know where they're from. I just know that, like, there's no way that the Ocampa could possibly exist as a species with the reproduction that they do. I assume that was something, if we were trying to make sense of it, and again, this is all more likely a goof by the writers than anything else, but it's if we're going to try to explain it, I think it's more likely that the Caretakers somehow forced them down that path and, like, genetically altered them so they have this ass-backwards, you know, reproduction cycle to keep their numbers under control. And I assume that they... That
it's all just a massive birth control experiment.
That's what I think. That's the only thing I can think of. Because otherwise it doesn't make any sense at all. And it kind of ties in with the whole, like, they used to have mind powers, and then they don't. And then once Kes leaves the Caretaker, suddenly she has mind powers again. Or she can learn them anyway. I'm waving my arms around real emphatically here.
It's true, he is. It's pretty enjoyable to watch. But, I think that entire story arc in of itself is very much a commentary on if a society or culture or race even doesn't continue to push its boundaries out further and further and further. It's just going to reach a point of stagnation to where it's just not going to develop any further, despite the fact that it could go on to do much better, greater things.
Keep that in mind. If we don't advance, we become the Ocampa.
We do become the Ocampa.
And the weirdest thing about Kes is that after her whole, like, you know, ascension, where she, like, throws Voyager 10 years closer to home, she comes back in a later episode, and she's all bitter and mad and, like, for some reason is indicating that she's had a real rough time since leaving Voyager. And it's like, Kes, you have, like, the ability to manipulate time and space. Like, what could possibly be causing you problems?
Yeah, really.
I mean, like, it just seems like she could... It just seems so weird. I don't remember what the explanation for it was. I just remember that she was really upset because she'd had, like, a shit time since leaving Voyager, and she blamed them for, like, taking her off their homeworld in the first place. And, like, they had to do some time shenanigans to fix it. And it was really silly. Even though I did like the scene where she was, like, walking down the corridor, making everything explode as she went, because that was kind of gratifying to watch.
Alright.
So we have the Ocampa, who are, like, sort of gaining the ability, and we have a bunch of races that already have it, just immediately.
Yep.
Like, the most example being the Q, the most obvious example.
Yes, they're timeless.
Yeah.
Right, so they were just, I don't know, whenever they started being, you know... If they can even have that, if they can be described that way as ever having come into being, because they're very much been described, self-described as being always, just always haven't been, right?
Right. Although I think they established at one point that they were originally a, you know, flesh and blood, meat brain race. I mean, it's sort of weird because if you think about it, it's like, okay, so this is a little bit of paradox coming going on here, but if you have a species, like, say, let's just use humans as a base drop. You have humans, or a human-like species, and they evolve to the point where they somehow make the leap and ascend into timelessness and the ability to manipulate time and space at will. Now, that would mean that even though they existed in linear time to the point where they ascended, because they're now timeless, they have also always existed. Which, I actually once had theorized that the Q are actually humans. Because at some point in the you know, who knows how long future in the Star Trek universe, humans will make that ascension, and then they will become timeless, which means they will always have existed, because they're now timeless. And so they are effectively checking in on themselves to see how they're doing in earlier time periods.
Let me get this straight.
That's just a thought, okay? It's just something to think about.
So Q are ascended humans... This is the theory you're throwing out there. I'm going to follow your logic
right
here.
Hypothesis, anyway.
All right, so as a result of them being ascended, they're always timeless. So they go back in time, being timeless that they are, and start judging themselves?
Yeah, they're, like, trying to shape their own evolution.
I don't know. Because encountering a far point really makes me think that Q just kind of wanted to swat him with the back of his hand and wipe him out.
Well, look, the Q have been so Q has been really inconsistent in the way he's been portrayed, and I really prefer to think of him as the mentor figure of humanity as opposed to the guy who just wants to wipe it all out. Because again, what Q wants with humanity kind of depends on which episode you're watching. But I prefer to think of him as a guiding force, and I can write off those episodes where he appears and acts really hostile as him just, you know, giving tough love.
Think he's had actually a very interesting story arc, personally, or character arc, excuse me, throughout the various series.
Oh?
Yeah. I mean, first we see him in Encounter Farpoint, and then after that, it's Q-Who, right?
No, it's Q-2. No, or something. The one where he gives Riker Q powers is
right, that's
time.
The next one, and then the one after that is the Borg one. And that's Deja Q. But the first few seasons of TNG, we very much have Prankster Q. And then after Deja Q, where we have him in, like, Tapestry and All Good Things, it's very much more serious Q. He pretty much stays serious Q all the way up until the Q Civil War in Voyager, right?
Let's not talk about the Q Civil War, okay?
Why
bring the Q Civil War into this? Goddamn Q Civil War. Qs are apparently weak to muskets.
I mean, Q was definitely... I'm talking John Delancey Q.
Right, obviously.
Where he was at first very much the prankster Q, and then he got, you know, slapped a few times by the Q Continuum saying, stop that, fall back in line. He very much did fall back in line, I think.
Except that timeline doesn't quite hold up, because in Encounter at Farpoint, he was doing the Continuum's bidding. He wasn't pranking. He was there at the behest.
Well, he did afterwards. He did afterwards.
And I actually think of Q-Who, the Borg. I don't think of that as Q the prankster. To me, that's more Q the mentor. You know, granted, in a very dangerous game of teaching. But, like, you know, he's clearly there to He's there to teach them something. I don't think that he's pranking them in that episode.
Well, maybe, maybe prank was the wrong word.
And, like, you could even say that in Q-less, I think, is the one where he gives Riker Q powers. That's a very poorly executed episode, but you could say that he's trying to teach them something there, too. If you, you know, sort of discount the really silly way it's presented.
Okay, well, my overall point is that his methods were really kind of much more harsh.
Yes.
You know, in, like, I'm not sure if I want to make this kind of analogy. I will anyway. If you look at Old Testament versus New Testament.
Oh, goodness. Oh, boy.
Old Testament God. Old Testament God is very much about wiping people out, right?
Yeah,
New Testament, it's like all love and whatnot, right? That's very much the dynamic I attribute to Q.
We call that a bleeding heart.
It's very much the dynamic I see with Q in, like, kind of TNG through there, and then now how I see him in Voyager. Of course, he's becoming more of that, not prank Q, but more of pushing boundaries and being controversial Q again later on in Voyager from what I'm seeing here, especially after Q Civil War. And he even says this himself about the other Q who wanted to kill himself, Quinn.
Yeah.
Right, how Quinn was saying, oh my gosh, you know, like, I really used to admire you and whatnot, because you're always being, like, you know, such this funky guy and whatnot. And I was like, oh, well, you're not that guy anymore. Now I'm sad.
He says that, but, like, that's, like, again, that only makes sense if you look at one version of Q. But, like, Q the prankster only, like, holds true in a certain number of episodes, and he doesn't actually, it's not like, those episodes aren't all in a row. It's not like he is Q the prankster, and then he becomes an agent of the Continuum. He originally starts off as an agent of the Continuum, and then he's a prankster for a couple episodes, and then he goes back to being an agent of the Continuum.
Uh-huh.
And so it's, again, it's not, I don't really see that as an arc. I see that as just character inconsistency. But, I mean, the Q's powers in and of themselves are clearly a manifestation of, you know, thought on reality. And they clearly interact with dimensions we can't even really think about.
Nope.
And it's always the question of, like, I sort of imagine, are the Q, like, is it really so much them being all powerful, or is it so much a matter of they are to us the way we would be to a two-dimensional being? That's sort of the way I see the Q.
So you think the Q then just exists in a higher state, or a different dimension then?
Yeah, that's sort of my view of the Q, is that they exist in, like, more dimensions or just in a higher plane than we do. And they're not, like, all-powerful. They just seem all-powerful to us because they can interact with the universe in ways that we are not able to because of our, you know, our spatial limitations.
Well, okay, then why don't we look at it this way? How would a two-dimensional being, then, see us? I mean, how would we interact with a two-dimensional plane?
Well, I think there's actually a story about that called Meet the Flatties.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't read it for a while. I've never read it, but as I understand it, basically the implication is that when a two-dimensional person sees a three-dimensional person, we're basically magic. Because, you know, we can go around barriers because we can just step into the third dimension because the barrier is two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
And we can, you know, we have the ability to create and destroy because we're three-dimensional. And it's not hard for us. And so, you know, to a two-dimensional person, a three-dimensional person is magic. And that's sort of how I view the Q. And I think that's sort of the way they're intended to be represented in the episodes where they're written well. And I think that's sort of ties in with the whole idea of, it's not that humanity is developing magic powers, it's that humanity is reaching a point where we are able to interact with more dimensions than we have currently. And I see that, I think that ties in pretty well with the Ocampa, as well as the Ocampa can tie into anything. and that's like what makes the Q different from, say, Trelane. Because when the Q were first introduced, there were a lot of comparisons made between them and Trelane. But the difference is that Trelane's not actually super powerful. He had a machine. And once they broke his machine, he was powerless. And he was like, you know, whereas the Q, or at least in the episode, some people have actually made the argument that the Q are just like Trelane and that they have some powerful technology. But it seems clear that
Trelane wasn't powerless. He was still able to conjure stuff up.
Well, I mean, he wasn't powerless, but he had a machine that once they broke it, Am I thinking of the wrong episode? I'm pretty sure once they broke Trelane's...
Squire of Gothos is where they all go down and he's all hanging out in the, like, late 17th century outfit. Or 18th century outfit.
Yeah, he's not completely powerless, but he's... he stops being a god once they break his technology. And so he has powers that we can, that we can comprehend and interact with, whereas the Q, because the Q don't rely on any form of technology, they simply act in dimensions we can't comprehend. So we have no way of, there's nothing that we can break to make Q lose his powers. Unless we have a musket, of course, as the Q Civil War proved. I mean, because of the Q Civil War, I half expected them to be able to restrain a Q by stopping him from snapping his fingers. Because, the Q Civil War writers forgot, or Kenneth Biller, I should say, is the writer, forgot that the Q's powers are all about metaphor. And it's like, okay, so we're metaphoring this as to look like the Civil War, okay? But suddenly now it's literal because we can pick up the muskets and fire them. So, that means that Q, by that extension, if you can stop Q from snapping his fingers, he can't use his power, right? Because that's, the literal, that's, taking the metaphor and making it literal. That's obviously really silly. But that's what they did in the Q Civil War. Sorry, I'm ranting about the Q Civil War now because I'm so mad about
it. I think that's just a lot of abstraction and metaphor abstraction and layers of that. as for using, the muskets and whatnot. I mean, that can go to, the harpoon gun my character had to use, right? He doesn't really know how it works. It's a gun. He knows it's a gun.
Right, but, first...
And he can kind of try to figure it out. I mean, and he fired a harpoon.
Yeah, he did. But first, I mean, the idea of a Q weapon being able to be used by a human being is sort of like giving a mouse an M16 and being here, use this. putting that aside, let's assume for a minute that the Q either made these weapons or modified them so they could be used by humans. We know that the Q can create, humanoid beings just out of thin air. That's a thing they can do.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't the Q fighting their battles with those if that actually works? If somehow those rifles, those muskets, because they also must have given the Voyager crew immunity to just being snapped out of existence... because none of the Q did that either.
Why don't they just snap each other out of existence?
Because the muskets are a metaphor. The muskets aren't real. There is no musket. Neither is there a spoon. The muskets are just a metaphor for the Q fighting each other. And the muskets are metaphors for some kind of technology or power that we cannot comprehend. And so our brains stops us from going insane by putting it through this filter. Which is why it gets so silly when a human picks up a musket and starts firing it. Because at that point, it's not a metaphor anymore. Now it is suddenly an actual musket.
Well, good job, Kenneth Biller. I'll tell you what.
Oh, God. Damn it. Okay.
Or is literally rubbing his temples.
I cannot. It's so dumb. But the Q Civil War aside, the Q do not depend on technology. They are literally just, either magic or super-dimensional beings. And there are a couple of creatures that they meet throughout Star Trek that can be sort of easily classified as being rogue Q or maybe even proto-Q. John Doe, I think, is the name he goes by.
Transfigurations, Next Generation.
Is that the one?
Yeah, it's the episode just before Best of Both Worlds in Season 3.
You're going to have to remind me what happens. I was actually thinking of something
else. All right, so they're picking up this distress signal from a planet. They go over, and then there's John Doe, as we know him, because I don't think we ever get his actual name.
Okay, right. He's the one who keeps having energy seizures.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right, glows yellow, and Worf goes over a barricade thing into the cargo shuttle bay thingamajig and gets his back broken or something.
But was that in the same episode?
Yes.
Worf breaking his back was the same episode as
well,
John?
Well, no, his neck was broken is what it was, because John had one of his, seizure things while they're up on this, catwalk thing,
mm-hmm.
and Worf goes over. I'm surprised you don't know what this is, because it's in the video of Worf gets pwned extended edition, over, twice, I think. Where he goes over the railing, and it's this really dumb jump thing where he's like, I did this really awesome gesture for those obviously listening to the podcast that can't see what I'm doing.
Yep.
This is the same episode where Geordi's trying to get hook up with that Christy Henshaw gal, and he goes and talks and says, oh my gosh, John, you gave me this awesome, courage to go ask her out and whatnot, even though it wasn't really...
Wait, did John give Geordi, like, success with the ladies? He really is a Q.
Literally. He gave him, like, a little mind probe thingamajig that made it all better for whatever reason. Because at the beginning of the episode, they go down the planet and John's life functions are waning because his brain can't, like, support it all because his body is so, like, exhausted from trying to heal itself that Crusher's like, all right, you're going to have to regulate all his body functions for him or help him with them. So they hook up the, you know, neural thing to both their heads.
And
there's that yellow discharge that goes into Geordi's head and Geordi, like, you know, real quick.
That sounds like a placebo effect if I ever heard one. Well, it's like, man, I got zapped by an alien. I'm awesome.
Well, it was just this really weird kind of, like, it was one of the subplots is what it was. It was just like, okay, I guess Geordi has found mojo from helping out John Doe with his body functions. It was just a really weird subplot. Anyway, the episode goes on to where we find out that John's body is going through a metamorphosis of some sort, where his cells, instead of being organic, are now starting to emit, like, this electric signal of some sort, to where they're now becoming energy, is what they are. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the episode, he turns into pure energy, is what it is, and he leaves. Now, we don't see him do anything supernatural, I think, aside from, well, one, fly through the wall of a ship as pure energy, and two, snap his fingers. He didn't actually snap his fingers, he just kind of raises a hand, and he transports the enemy captain of the, I think they're called Zalconians, is the name of the race, from the bridge of their ship to the Enterprise, and then back or something like that, I think is what happened. I mean, so we don't see anything other than that that's, like, supernatural about it, but the idea is that there's a change happening to their race, and these others had gone off to let this change happen while everyone else is afraid of it.
Right, they were, like, the story is that they're a bunch of them are changing, and the powers that be are like, no, we don't want this, and, like,
this is bad, this mutation, it's a sickness, we can't have this happen.
And they, like, kill anyone who starts to change.
Yeah, and they were hunting down that shuttle, and they crash-landed, and they assumed everyone was dead, but, you know.
This is a serious problem when the people you're hunting are changing into immortal energy beings. It's like, ooh, they got your work cut out for you there.
Yeah, so... But that was just another example of everyone seems to be on this evolutionary path towards being pure energy. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if John was, you know, existing in another dimension, like you're saying the Q do, but it was definitely this, you know, upward shift into, oh my gosh, I'm energy now, I'm better than all of you.
Yeah.
At least, you know, in mind and body, quote unquote.
I mean, if we want to get into actual physics for a minute here, pure energy.
Well, I do. That's part of the episode I wanted.
Right. All right. So getting to actual physics for a minute, pure energy is, as I understand it to work, is not real. Because energy is measured by matter.
Right.
So, like, you can't, as I understand it, you can't have energy without matter, because, like, energy is something that is possessed by matter.
Right.
And so pure energy would still have to be matter of some sort. Otherwise, what is the energy exactly?
Well, right, exactly. This is one of the questions that I have about this and why I bring up all these races and whatnot. It's like, there seems to be this evolutionary trend towards pure energy in Star Trek. Why?
Well, I think because pure energy sounds cool. I mean, I don't know. When you say pure energy, people kind of conjure this idea of, like, this man made of lightning or something. Never mind that lightning is also matter. A quick tangent. I found out that there's a galaxy somewhere far off that every once in a while will shoot off a bolt of lightning that's longer than the Milky Way.
What?
Yep, there's one of the galaxies in relatively nearby, you know, in galactic terms. Is this galaxy that has, like, the theory is that it has, like, a supermassive black hole in the center of it that has this incredibly powerful electrical field.
Okay.
And that every once in a while, it will just shoot off an electrified beam of matter, which is basically a giant lightning bolt, like the size of a galaxy.
All right.
So, yeah, and I have no idea how we can see that, but this is a thing that NASA's been talking about. So it turns out there's weird stuff in space.
Not like radiation and stuff.
Yeah. But see that actually is exactly what I'm saying, is that even with lightning, which is, like, sort of the manifestation of energy, there's still matter involved. So pure energy is a misconception. And what I assume they mean by that is, like, he's turning into something that has the ability to manipulate energy with ease. And so, like, you know, you can have as much energy as you want in this new form. Whereas in our current forms that are made of meat, it takes a lot of effort for us to process any kind of energy.
As much energy as you want, so you essentially have infinite energy
yeah.
at all times.
Or you are able to process it in ways that we cannot, you know, that we cannot comprehend of via, you know, higher dimensions and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's especially since, like, most of the time this ascension into a higher plane is accompanied by them disappearing. That's sort of how I view it, is that they are literally going into a dimension we can no longer perceive. Now, that's not true of Kes. Kes just had, like, apparently just had super mojo. She wasn't in a higher dimension. She just had psychic powers. But I think maybe if she could, you know, if she could live longer than 9 years, maybe she'd get there eventually.
That was so unfortunate for the Ocampans.
Yeah, I know, right? Nine years.
The Ocampa.
Ocampa,
that's plural, right?
Yeah, whatever.
All right.
I don't know. But yeah, I think that like dramatically speaking, the reason why this is such a common trend in Star Trek and in sci-fi in general, you know, if I had a nickel for every time someone in a sci-fi was evolving towards pure energy, actually, I'm listening to a sci-fi podcast right now of a novel called The Falcon Banner, where a bunch of the characters just found an old abandoned human fleet, and the people that used to be on it ascended and became pure energy.
Okay.
So there you go. This is a really common sci-fi trope. And I think that the reason for it is the idea that we really want to believe that human potential is limitless.
Uh-huh.
That we can just keep getting better. And eventually that needs to become metaphorical, and like you have to put in some kind of weird thing to make it, like, you know, take it to the next level, as it were. Especially in sci-fi, when humans are surrounded by computers and robots and aliens that do things better than us in all ways, mm-hmm. we have to put in something to make us feel like we're still cool. And in general, I don't think it's a bad message. I think that it's definitely something that we could do to see more of, is to see, you know, fiction where it's actually encouraged that humans can grow to be more than they are. Because it feels like a lot to me, like in a lot of fiction nowadays, it's being sort of portrayed this idea that humans have to struggle to not become less than they are. And there's a lot of, and you know, just because television has taken a darker turn recently,
uh-huh.
There's a whole lot of really gritty humans acting like assholes to each other. And there's nothing wrong with that. I enjoy a good Battlestar Galactica as much as the next man.
Right.
But it's also nice to see the sci-fi that has a more optimistic view of the human condition. And is like, you know, hey, you guys can actually be better if you try. So that's where it comes from dramatically. As for the actual pure energy term, that just sounds cool. Doesn't pure energy sound cool? I want to be pure energy.
I don't know. I guess I'm indifferent to the idea of pure energy. I'm pretty attached to my mortal coil.
I could stand with being pure energy, even though pure energy is not real. I could totally be it.
What would you do?
I would be pure energy is what I would do.
Do what, though?
I don't know. I'd power a light bulb or something. I'd power a lot of light bulbs.
Power light bulbs.
I would, like...
solve the energy world crisis?
I would do
world
sky...
energy crisis?
Yeah, I would do skywriting. I would write my name out of myself in the air. And, I don't know, I would be a firebender.
So how long... firebender. So how long ago bloodbend? There you go.
Oh, dear.
That sounds like a more fun activity than just me. Just to me, anyway. Yeah, I mean, let's just say that we could ascend to pure energy.
Yeah.
I mean...
whatever pure energy is.
What would you do? What's your, I guess, mandate at that point?
Well, in theory...
light bulb powering aside...
Again, in theory, if you're going with the idea that...
I mean, the Q are kind of a prime example of this. They're bored.
Yeah, they are.
Right?
But, like, you don't have to take it to quite the same extreme as the Q. If you're going with the assumption that this ascension means that you are now inhabiting dimensions higher than normal, you still have limits. Like, you know, being a five-dimensional being, let's say, because we're effectively three-dimensional, and, like, we are moving through time, which you could count as a fourth dimension, but we have no control over that.
Uh-huh.
So if we were, like, a five-dimensional being, we had control over time and then some other fifth dimension that I don't know what it would be, mm-hmm. but if we had five dimensions, we would still have limits. We wouldn't be able to do anything. We would just be able to do more than we could before, and there would still be other creatures that would be of that higher dimension that would act in opposition to us, and there would still be problems to solve. There'd be different problems. But the other, it's much less interesting if you take the route of, well, we don't really our perceptions don't change, we just gain superpowers. That's what Kes did. Like, Kes didn't evolve in any way, she just became, like, practically all-powerful. Which is why it was so weird that her return episode is how she's had such a horrible time since leaving Voyager.
She stayed in the third dimension instead of traveling to the fifth dimension, like she was supposed to.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, I mean, it's sort of like if you, just to use a very simple metaphor, if you stayed in preschool and kept doing preschool work, for your entire life, even though you became older and smarter and much more physically capable and much more mentally capable, you'd be really bored.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean that once you become an adult, you are suddenly, you know, incapable of finding things that interest you. You just have to leave preschool. Hopefully you leave preschool before you become an adult.
Right.
But, you know, that's, I'm just going to use that as my metaphor here. Since we've long ago ditched actual science and we're totally in metaphor country now.
We are in metaphor country. But that's okay, because we're talking about sci-fi and such.
And speaking of metaphor, I actually wanted to get into some of the, like, if we take the manipulation of time and space and move away from, like, beings that can do it for a minute and go into, like, spatial anomalies.
And oh, man.
The way that those are represented in fiction. And we have a couple, there are three big examples that I wanted to use. First, we have parallels, which is, and again, because this is all metaphor.
The episode parallels?
Yeah, the episode parallels.
Okay, that's where Worf...
That's where Worf stumbles into a hole in reality, and he starts, like, shifting through dimensions.
Right.
And in each dimension, there's one thing that's a little different, and as he gets farther and further from his, you know, quote, home dimension, things get weirder and weirder.
The idea being that there's all these dimensions because anything that can't happen does happen.
Yeah.
Right, and all these parallel universes.
Leading to that really famous... image of, like, a million branching pathways.
Yes.
And in that episode...
And a sector full of enterprises.
Yes, and at the end of it, they do get a sector full of enterprises. And that is a big, big metaphor for the what-if question. Because we always wonder, what if, you know, the road less traveled by, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
We always wonder what would have happened if, you know, I'd had Pepsi instead of Coke... Or, you know, if I'd...
I don't lose sleep over that kind of stuff. But if you do, Orin, it's okay. Well, we can get you help.
My soft drink choice weighs deeply on my mind. But, you know, if, you know, the big one that I'm always seeing come up in romantic comedies is, what if I'd asked that girl out?
Right.
But, you know, there's all these questions that we wonder what would have happened if we'd made a different choice. And that's, you know, that's this inherent thing that we have when trying to deal with free will is, like, well, we have all these decisions, but we can only make one decision. And so that's...
Unless you go the Tina Fey route, where she's trying to get to that guy in the airport, but she can't take the sandwich with her.
Oh, goodness.
She can have it all.
I do love 30 Rock, because I can have it all. Anyway, and so that's what Parallels is, because Parallels is, you know, literally Worf just going through and seeing all these things that would have happened if things had turned out just a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's where the, that was originally...
radically differently in some cases.
Yeah, well, as you make more and more decisions differently, things are going to be even weirder.
Right.
But, like, you know, there's the first, that was the first episode where they really introduced the idea of Worf and Troi as a couple, because there's the, one of the dimensions he goes into is that they're married.
Mm-hmm.
And that they got married after the incident where he broke his back and she was basically taking care of his kid.
Right.
And, you know, there was, and so, like, yeah, I could totally see that. And that was, like, that was an interesting thing. It was, like, well, what if we traveled this route? And that was, like, showed us, you know, we got to see some of Worf as a character and where he could have gone instead of the direction he ended up going.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, lots of sci-fi uses the alternate dimension, trope. To show us different alternate endings. Just recently we played in a game of Mage where we went dimension hopping to steal artifacts because, like, we needed these artifacts to save our timeline from being destroyed.
I loved that session.
And so we went and stole a bunch of the artifacts from other timelines because they didn't need them as much as we did.
Nope, our timeline is more important than theirs.
Well, fortunately, none of the characters who would have questioned the morality of this were in that game. So we were okay.
Yep.
But, you know, so that's a trope that comes up a whole lot. And as a whole, I really like this episode, and I've heard some people complain about it because they feel like it sort of implies that nothing that happens to the Enterprise is important because there's, like, a million other Enterprises out there. And I think that's kind of false reasoning. There are a million other humans out there, but what happens to me is really important to me, because it's me, and I don't care, you know, and it's like, you know, it's the, there's the parable of the man who's throwing starfish back into the ocean. There's, like, a beach full of starfish. and he's throwing them back into the ocean. Someone's like, why are you doing this? You can't change, you know, you can't save all the starfish. And he's like, well, I can save this one. And so the idea that just because there are, I mean, by that logic, it's like, well, there are other Federation ships, so what happens to this one can't be important, right?
Well, a lot of Miranda and Excelsior's out there, you know.
So I think that that's kind of an unfair criticism to make, and I think that in general it was cool, and I was, you know, also because TNG is just starved for Worf development episodes.
Yes.
We really needed some, and that's one of the few that he has developed in a way that doesn't make him look like a huge doofus.
It's kind of funny you actually mentioned that. Because our buddy Jim is actually going through The Next Generation right now.
Yeah, he is.
And he's got this real knack of watching an episode and then saying, it's just like a quick one-line like sentence that is something that's totally like turning it on its head about the way I had thought about the episode. Like, recently he just watched Birthright Parts 1 and 2, where Worf goes and finds
Love this one.
Did you see it on Facebook?
Yeah, I did.
All right, so he says, good job, Worf, or something similar to the effect of, I'm kind of paraphrasing.
What he says, I can actually say it word for word.
Yeah.
What he says is, so Worf finds a planet of Klingons who are nice, and he turns them into violent racists. Good job, Worf.
I just kind of had to stand back for a minute and go, you know what? I think he's right.
For those of you who don't know what episode we're talking about, Birthright is the episode where Worf hears a rumor that his father might have survived Khitomer. He goes and he finds this penal colony of Klingons, some of whom are either the descendants of or actual prisoners taken from the Khitomer outpost by the Romulans.
Mm-hmm.
And they live with their Romulan like guards, as it were, basically in peace. And they're not even really prisoners anymore. They just live there because that's what they've known for so long.
Yep.
And the ones who weren't born there know that they can't ever go back to the Empire. And the ones that were
born
there...
Well, the excuse they're fed is that... Well, not really excuse, but the reasoning is that because there's just so much war and violence going on, that's just much safer to stay here.
And like the children who were born there, they don't have any reason to want to leave. They've never known anything else.
Right.
And the idea is that the intent of the episode is that these Klingons are being denied their cultural heritage.
Right.
And that Worf has to come in and show and explain to them where they come from and to be proud of themselves and who they are. And that episode also has this really hilarious moment where Brother pointed out where one of the Klingons is like using a spear to like do some digging or something.
Some, like gardening.
Yeah, some gardening. And it's like, first of all, that spear would make a really bad gardening tool.
Yes.
And second, it looks like it's been recently polished. Like, it's shining
brand
new. And it's like, you guys have... We know they have replicators. We see them. They could replicate a freaking spade. But instead, they're using this spear.
Using this ceremonial, like, spear
Why
weapon.
Do you even have that ceremonial spear? Where did that come from?
To plow the fields, Orin. To plow the fields.
But that episode does have a really cool Klingon song in it. I really love Klingon songs. Like,
oh, that one that was being sung is actually a lullaby, but it's not really a lullaby.
Well, no, it's not a lullaby. It's like a victory song.
But it was being sung as a lullaby.
Was it?
Yeah. Remember the lead?
No, I'm talking about the one where the Worf's like Klingon friend comes in with like an animal he's just killed, and is like, "I'm so cool, I killed this animal." And then he starts like, and then he like speaks the first couple lines.
Yeah, it's the same song. Just that that guy who I don't remember his name had told Worf that he was sung that song when he was a child as a lullaby, and then you also see the female Klingon Romulan lead singing that to a child as well as a lullaby, but they didn't know what the song meant.
I forgot about that. But yeah, although apparently their universal translators couldn't translate it.
Nope, can't do it.
But that's a really cool song. I really like the Klingon songs are just awesome.
Yeah, they are.
But yeah, I mean, Jim is right to an extent. Worf does take this colony where Klingons and Romulans are peacefully coexisting and ruin it because he feels like they're living wrong.
Yep.
And, like, you know, it's sort of disturbing in that it sort of implies that the Klingons are naturally predisposed to hate Romulans. And that, like, all Worf has to do is kind of give them a push, and suddenly all of their instincts will reawaken. And like,
well, Worf's got personal beef
with
Romulans all up and down the avenue, so I mean...
But I feel like in that episode, Worf, like, basically let his personal hatred of the Romulans... push him into doing something that was wrong. I don't feel like he, like, like, in the end, we see that the Romulans, when it comes to shove, the Romulans let them leave. Like, they're not really prisoners. So I feel like Worf, like, really wasn't being fair to the Romulans in that episode, because the Romulans were just trying to live peacefully with these prisoners and the children of these prisoners that they had. They weren't, like, you know, mistreating them. And Worf was just like, I hate all Romulans, even though you guys weren't the ones who did bad things. And I like that Worf is racist, actually. I like that part of his character. I liked how the Narendra 3 incident, or the Nirvana 3 incident, I forget.
Narendra
3. When there was the Romulan who needed his blood, blood. Regardless, it was the one where they had a captured Romulan and he was dying.
That was Glorndon Khor.
Yeah, Glorndon Khor. And there was a Romulan who was dying, and he needed a blood transfusion from Worf, and Worf was like, I'm not giving you one. And, like, he didn't just magically get over it at the end of the episode. I really liked that. But in this episode, I really feel like this could have been a development point for Worf, where he could have learned that maybe hating Romulans unconditionally wasn't a good thing.
Mm.
And he just never did. He never grew beyond that. I wanted him to. Even in DS9, he never grew beyond it, because they never really had him confront any Romulans in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. With that 10-minute tangent out of the way.
Yeah, okay, now that we're done talking about Worf. Just to show you how metaphors of spatial technology can go out of hand, we have Parallax, which is the second episode of Voyager, which is the episode where they establish, or I guess the third, technically, because the first one was a two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one where they establish that they can't interface the rest of their power systems with the holodeck, which was their excuse for why they were running the holodeck, even though they were supposed to be low on power and supplies.
Uh-huh.
But that was also... So the premise of that episode is that, like, Voyager sees a ship being sucked into a black hole, and then it ends up that the ship being sucked into a black hole is actually Voyager,
mm-hmm.
because of a time distortion, they're seeing themselves.
Right.
They do that, but the thing about it is that, like, the reason why that anomaly isn't very well presented, and then they have that whole thing where they talk about the event horizon of a black hole as if it's a literal barrier as opposed to a mathematically defined boundary.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they do that all wrong. But the real reason why that anomaly is silly is it doesn't really do anything in terms of character. It doesn't show us anything new about any of the characters, other than we learn that Janeway is really silly and will fly a shuttle into a black hole with her future chief engineer rather than sending someone else to do it.
Yep.
Because apparently they were the only two people on the ship who could do the job.
Only people.
They didn't actually do anything, really. They just sort of, as I recall, they took the shuttle out and sprayed some magic particles into the hole in the event horizon to make it bigger.
Mm.
And then they had to play the guessing game of which Voyager was the right one.
Yep.
And so, like, that anomaly doesn't really teach us anything new about the characters. They don't use it in any kind of interesting way. It's just kind of there to take up space.
Yep.
And apparently, the guy who did the original pitch, a guy named Jim Trombetta, or Trombetta, I don't know how to pronounce it exactly. But
sure, we'll roll with that. We'll call him Mr. T.
Yeah, he wasn't the teleplay writer, but he was the guy who came up with the original story. His original pitch was actually supposed to be about the Doctor. And the idea was that the Doctor kept getting sent, like, each time Voyager would get sucked into the black hole and destroyed, and they would send the Doctor as a package of information back to the previous Voyager in the time cycle, with information on how to avoid getting sucked into the black hole. And that sounds, you know, that sounds a little wonky, but at least that sounds like
like an expansion of the idea of cause and effect from TNG.
Yeah. That is exactly what it sounds like. And it feels like they could have used the spatial anomaly to better extent if they'd done that, even though it would have been kind of copying cause and effect. I think it would have been better than what they did.
Uh-huh.
Cause and effect is another great one with the spatial anomaly. But the last episode on my list of spatial anomalies is All Good Things. I just want to talk about that one because that's just a really well-crafted episode.
Time and anti-time.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's got some silly techno babble. So that's no two ways around that. But it has the Q in it, who we were just talking about as being like spatial manipulators.
Uh-huh.
And then it's got these spatial anomalies that like grow bigger in the past, which I think is a cool idea, even though the way they explain it is kind of silly. And it's got like the big point of the episode is Picard. Like overcoming his thought limitations and figuring out the paradox, And he even, like, and even though there's a weird inconsistency where they say it's like all three beams originated from the Enterprise, even though one beam originated from
the Pasteur.
Picard actually references that when he realizes the paradox. He's like, "We started it when the three Enterprises. I mean, when the Pasteur did." And he's like, "Wait, what? That doesn't quite make sense."
No, that's cool, bro.
And I was like, you know, to me that was part of the paradox. And like the whole time shifting that Picard does during that episode, where we get to see a little bit of, you know, that, and then, like, dramatically speaking, that was just really cool, because we got to see the past, present, and future of TNG, which is a really nice way to end out the series.
Stupid three-celled
galaxy. Hey, now.
Galaxy.
Hey, nothing wrong with the three-celled galaxy, okay?
Totally wrong with it. It actually goes against Gene Roddenberry's design document for Starships.
You know, I have to say, as much respect as I have for Gene Roddenberry, I don't care. I don't care about his design document for Starships, and I don't care about them always having two nacelles, okay?
I still think it looks dumb.
I think it looks fine. It costs
$25 in Star Trek Online,
well,
too.
It's stupid in Star Trek Online, but to me, it made sense because the whole plot of that episode is that Riker is only still flying the Enterprise because he's an admiral, and he gets to do what he wants.
Choose his ship.
And so I always imagined that the Enterprise was going to have been retired by now, which is why it's got all this extra stuff glued to it, because it needed to be retrofitted, like, a million times to still be, like, you know, competitive against the Klingon Nekfar classes.
We do have Spinal Phaser Lance now with that.
Yep, in Star Trek Online, you can get the spinal phaser mount, and it's basically a big phaser jousting thing.
It is.
I'd imagine it'd be good against, like, big boss ships that don't turn, but it sounds like it would be really hard to use against other more agile ships that can just stay out of your front arc.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't personally used it, but it used to be a very devastating weapon, and now it's just kind of like, at least from what I've seen it used anyway. If anyone actually even uses it anymore...
I don't know. It's $25 worth of usefulness. But again, that's like the anomaly in All Good Things is actually part of the story and is sort of the centerpiece of it. And that's, you know, and as I've talked about before, that's part of what sci-fi is using these science fiction and technological and, you know, and temporal ideas to tell a story. And to show us something interesting about the human condition.
Right.
And, you know, and that's what All Good Things does. And even though, and it's Star Trek is weird because, like other sci-fi stories can kind of get away with this more easily than Star Trek, but because Star Trek is a series that has multiple episodes, it does seem to feel like the space-time continuum in Star Trek is just coming apart at the seams.
Yep.
Because it's like, you know, you take how many episodes that just shows that the ships that we've watched have encountered these spatial ripping distortions, and then you multiply that by how many other ships there are flying around, and it's like, God, how many of these are there?
Yeah, really.
These have to be everywhere.
Because there are also references to other ships visiting that kind of stuff, too.
Yeah, there are.
I mean, so, how dangerous is space? My goodness.
Well, see, this is why in Star Trek, you always have to have a science officer, because space is just full of these anomalies that want to eat your ship
always
whole.
Always a science officer.
If you don't have a science officer, you're just silly.
Well, that can be our answer to Jim, then, when he asks why his ship has science console slots.
Yeah, well, you know, Jim just wants more phasers. Jim is a simple man.
Jim is a simple man.
And God, this is reminding me that in Star Trek Online, one of the things I noticed that weirds me out is how big the bridges are. Like, the bridge on your ship is like, it's like a dance hall.
It is.
And it's all the consoles are super spread out, and there's only like 10 people on it, and it's all this space. And I'm like, you know, I feel like I could put an extra shield generator in here.
It's an aesthetic that a lot of people don't like about that. And especially, did I ever show you the shuttle interior at all?
No, you never did.
Okay. Well, you know what a Type 8 shuttle with the inside of that is supposed to look like, right?
Is that the standard TNG shuttle?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so, and that's more or less what we see in Voyager 2, is that kind of smaller cockpit, right? So, they released this was actually a while ago, they released releasing screenshots of the inside of the shuttle, and everyone thought it was going to be, the inside of a runabout, because this thing was massive on the inside. Like, sweet, that's a cool runabout interior. It's like, oh no, this is the shuttle interior. It's like, this is way too big for the shuttle interior.
It's
man.
Cool. Starfleet has discovered TARDIS technology.
I mean, the justification for all these things, like big bridges, big interiors, big shuttle interiors, is that they need to accommodate the cameras.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your actual gameplay camera one now, which I can understand. I completely understand that from a game design standpoint. Now, when you're talking Star Trek, and you're trying to stay true to Star Trek form, you got to make it smaller. You just have to. Now, it's going to be free to play soon. So it doesn't really matter what I do with my dollar at this point, because it's going to be free to play before the end of the year. Hopefully before, like, the Old Republic comes out, because otherwise they're going to be
kind of sucked. The Old Republic is going to suck anyway. I mean, everything I've seen about the Old Republic suggests that it's literally just a WoW clone with a Star Wars screen put over it. Like, I mean, I've looked into it, and I'm actually amazed how much of a WoW clone it is. Like, I was expecting it to at least be a little different. It isn't. And I don't really know why anyone's surprised. I mean, BioWare makes single-player linear RPGs. I don't know why anyone thought they could make a Memorpurger. which is like, you know, I don't know. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about.
That is not what we're talking about.
I think we've about played out our episode for this week.
I think we have. What are we talking about next week?
Next week, well, actually, it's going to be in a couple days. We're actually recording this episode on Wednesday.
It's true, it's
because
not Wednesday.
Our weekend got all messed up.
It's true.
But this weekend, we are going to discuss horror in Star Trek in honor of Halloween. And horror in Star Trek is pretty cool, as we will describe.
It involves
a lot of dark hallways. And for that, that is All Things Trek, signing off.